Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to the History of Islam podcast, episode 8, the first few chapters. Assalamu alaikum, hello and welcome to another installment of the History of Islam podcast. Last episode we reached the birth of an orphan boy in Mecca, and with that we took a look at what the rest of the world is up to and the developments away from Mecca, specifically in the north and the imperial powers that surrounded Arabia at the time. This episode we're making a return back to Arabia and back to Mecca to look at the first few chapters of Muhammad's life. One of the customs of the settled Arabs, particularly the nobles in places like Mecca and Ta'if, for example, was to send off the newborn babies to the desert to live a Bedouin lifestyle. And there were several reasons for this practice, which mostly fall under the umbrella of a Bedouin lifestyle being considered simply better. So I'm going to go over a few reasons why this was the case. The first is that it was considered healthier. Bedouin lifestyle was considered healthier, as the desert air was considered fresher and cleaner than that of a city, so the baby was more likely to survive. Infant mortality was a much bigger problem in antiquity than it is today. And we can assume that one of the reasons this was is because of the diseases and epidemics that are more likely to rise up when people are living more densely situated. They live in together in higher concentrations, which is the case in cities. With a nomadic lifestyle, this becomes less of a problem. And a nomadic lifestyle, in comparison with a settled life, has a much lower population density. The second reason is that a Bedouin lifestyle was a better upbringing for the child, character-wise. It would result in a better person, a better adult. And this was because a Bedouin lifestyle was, again, considered very noble by the Arabs. One reason for this was that the independence aspect that we talked about a few episodes ago, as a proud people, the Arabs tended to value independence quite highly, and the Bedouins as nomads were the peak of independence, roaming about in total freedom, drifting with the desert sands. Another reason is that, as Martin Lings said, nobility and freedom were inseparable for the Arabs. For you to be considered noble and to carry the prestige that a noble Arab would have, you have to be free. And the nomad was as free as he can be. The place that he pegged his tent yesterday was different to the place that he was eating his lunch the next day. But a townsman, on the other hand, was a virtual prisoner, bound to one place yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The nomad, due to his lifestyle, is always alert, always ready and prepared for whatever, whereas the townsman allows the comforts of the town to lull him to sleep and complacency, where he loses his edge, he loses his alertness and his vigilance. The town ended up being seen as a place that was essentially corrupted, or at least allowed manly and noble characteristics to decay. Even things like language, which was highly prized by the Arabs, poetry was pretty much the only method of cultural output that the Arabs practiced. But we'll come back to that in a second. The three distinct elements that formed the person in this society, and the elements that he was assessed by, are strength, intelligence, and your character, or the nobility of your character. And all of these were assessed under two categories. You personally were assessed as an individual, so your personal ability and your personal reputation. And the second category is your tribe and your tribe's reputation. So if we look at the first of those three elements, strength was measured and assessed by the power of the tribe that you were from and the numbers of people who would go up in arms to protect you. And the second segment of this is your personal martial abilities. So when looking at specifically personal strength and personal abilities, the two things that were highly and most valued were horsemanship and marksmanship, which were both greatly featured and emphasized in a nomadic lifestyle. Someone who is a nomad is more likely to be a better horseman and a better archer than someone who engaged in a settled lifestyle. This is because a nomad is riding around everywhere, they're using their bow to hunt the animals that they ate, whereas a person that is settled doesn't do that much of those activities. You know, they rely on the herds that they slaughtered rather than hunting. You don't move around as much if you're settled. So that was why a nomad is more likely to have those skills more deeply embedded in their persona and more honed and refined. The second element was intelligence. And intelligence was measured by eloquence and oratorical skill. Philip K. Heaty, in his book The History of the Arabs, says that no people in the entire world manifest such enthusiastic admiration for literary expression. Just to emphasize this further, there is actually an Arab proverb that declares that the beauty of a man lies in the eloquence of his tongue. The most dominant form of literary expression was poetry, without a doubt. The crown of eloquence for the Arabs was poetry. This is because an Arab poet was not just someone who was a good speaker. No, the poet had much more functionality than just that. The Arabian poet for his tribe was a historian. He had to be well versed in the genealogy of his tribe, its roots, and the folklore of his people, so that he can sing praises and compose poems that will praise his tribe and all that they had attained in the past, and their achievements and their accolades over the years. He also had to be aware of the past of rival tribes, so that he could expose their shortcomings and their failures, bringing them to light and mocking them. In this field, he ended up becoming a journalist also, a moulder of public opinion, the media of that day. The poems that he composed were committed to memory by the people who listened to them, and they would end up spreading from tongue to tongue, one person to another, quite rapidly. These poets would basically have the opportunity to become the celebrities of their day. To have a great and well-known poet in your family or your tribe even was something to be definitely extremely proud of. Due to the poet's role as a media agent and a moulder of public opinion, some leaders or even rich and wealthy men would sponsor and pay these poets to compose poems that would include high words of praise, exalting them, or words of scorn and ridicule aimed at their enemies, disparaging them. The words of a poet were so effective that they were enough to incite masses of people to battle and to war. An example of this in action is Harb al-Basus, the Basus War. What was the Basus War? Well, it was a war literally over a single camel that raged on for about 40 years, generations of people fighting. The flames of war were kept alight, burning brightly by the words of poets on both sides, urging and inciting their compatriots to avenge the deaths of their kinsmen and hurling insults and barbs at their enemies. Going back to the initial point of sending babies off to be raised up by Bedouins in the desert was considered a better, nobler, and purer case, even with language, because in a city or a town, language is more susceptible to corruption, and as a result of its corrupted state, it can decay. This is because in a city, you are less isolated, so you come into contact with other languages, which then influence your language and reduce its purity. A trading city like Mecca was more vulnerable to this. As we mentioned earlier, in Arab society, a man's intelligence was largely assessed by his eloquence, and so eloquence and beauty of speech were virtues which all Arab parents desired for their children. Due to the nature of Bedouin lifestyle and the isolating factor of desert life, the Arabic language was considered purest in the desert, as that is where it was exposed to less external factors such as foreign languages that could taint it. And this is further evidenced by the fact that the best poets seem to nearly always be from a Bedouin desert tribe. The third of the three elements that we mentioned earlier is character, or nobility of character. And this was assessed in branches in a similar way to strength. Number one, your personal character and your personal reputation. And number two, the reputation of your tribe, the people that you were from. The ideal of Arab virtue was expressed in terms of something called murua. Murua is a word that really doesn't really have a direct translation to English, and this is because its meaning in English is actually a concoction of many words. Murua is the virtues of the perfect, ideal Arab man. The component elements of it were things like courage, bravery, discipline, stoicism, honor, loyalty, generosity, manliness, your worthiness and quality in general as a man. Courage and bravery were assessed by your martial ability, for example, your skill with a bow or your skill as a horseman. Your courage and bravery was also measured by the number of battles and raids that you have participated in and the way you behaved in those military confrontations. Your discipline, stoicism, also bravery and courage to an extent, was assessed by the way you overcame hardship, how you dealt with difficult circumstances. And this is easily instilled in a man who lives a desert nomadic Bedouin lifestyle, where it is absolutely normal to go days on end sustaining yourself only on camel's milk and some dates. Your loyalty was assessed by how you behaved with your kinsmen, your level of preparedness to support and aid them in times of need, which was very important in a society where an individual's security was reliant on quid pro quo policies. You know, don't mess with me, because if you do, I've got all these people that will back me up or avenge me tenfold. Your generosity, honor, and overall nobility of character were assessed by things like your hospitality, which was a major aspect of Bedouin culture. It's your readiness to sacrifice animals and bring out the best you have with no reservation for your guests and your friends. Your honor was assessed by other ways you behaved, for example, always upholding a deal, never cheating anyone you dealt with. Prestige is culminated through this kind of behavior. And what is prestige? Prestige is just respect. And the Bedouin code basically dictated that the ideal man should always be respected and behave in a way that led people to respect him. And this is why slights were never taken lightly, as it would reduce the amount of respect that other people had for you. And on top of this, in a ruthless society, letting anything go inadvertently encourages others to behave towards you in the same way, which could be detrimental in a land like Arabia, where you can simply never allow yourself to appear weak, because all it will do is encourage people to attack you or harm you one way or another. This is why pride is such a huge factor, in the character of the Arab. This kind of attitude had its positives and negatives. It created a very hardy, very tough people who had a great potential if someone could unite them and harness them effectively and efficiently towards one goal, which is what Muhammad and the Banner of Islam managed to accomplish. But it also had many negatives. One of these is that not only is uniting people like this extremely difficult, the egos that will be butting heads will be hard to manage and to caress, but it would also lead to a lot of pointless bloodshed, as we have seen already, where people would spend themselves for very little. If I go back to the example of the Besus War that I mentioned earlier, we see a very clear example of the downsides of the attitudes prevalent in the character of the Arabs. Long story short, the Besus War was basically ignited after a camel belonging to one tribe was killed by another tribe. The tribe owning the camel had to react. They couldn't just let it go because it will lead people to think that they could kill their camels, they can take their camels no matter what. So they have to react in order to maintain the level of prestige and respect that they had, and in order to remain feeling honorable. On the other hand, the tribe that had actually killed the camel refused to concede, because not only is there a risk that they may appear weak and vulnerable to the people around them, which would encourage attacks and raids, the camel had actually strayed onto their territory. And for them, nobody could tell them what they could and what they could not do on their territory. In fact, as far as they were concerned, anything that was on their territory was rightfully theirs. This, essentially, the death of one she-camel resulted in about 40 years of bloodshed. And obviously, this is quite a big downside to having those kind of characteristics and those kinds of personality traits prevalent in a society. Going back on track, the nobles of Quraysh would send their babies off to the desert and to pure Bedouin nomadic tribes so that their children would have the qualities that we have just spoken about, and so that they would grow up refined, uncorrupted, and most importantly, untainted by city life. The bond with the desert was renewed practically every generation, and I personally think that this was a pretty good policy, and I wonder why it sort of petered out and it wasn't continued on a wide scale after the early Islamic conquests that established the Arabs in Mesopotamia, the Levant, the wider Middle East, basically. And I also wonder what the impact on the world would have been if other nomadic groups around the world had this kind of policy. For example, the Mongols in particular. The Mongols in China had a very hard time keeping their culture alive and keeping their identity alive. It simply leads you to wonder what could have been if the Mongols had a similar kind of policy where they would maintain and renew with every generation a bond with the steppe where they had come from, in a similar manner to the way I'm describing that the Bedouins and Quraysh would do now. Instead of what did happen, which was they quickly melted away and they assimilated to the culture of the peoples that they had conquered. Just some food for thought. Muhammad, like the children of Mecca, was...
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Sent off to be raised and suckled by a Bedouin tribe, and every 6 months, the children would be brought back to see their parents and their families, and then they would return to the desert. Unfortunately, it wasn't long before tragedy would again hit the young boy. At the age of 6, his mother also passed away, and so he was taken in by his grandfather, who would take care of him. His grandfather had already had a somewhat significant and notable role in his upbringing and in helping his mother Amina take care of him. Now, that role was to be enlarged into the much bigger position, a much more important position as sole guardian. But that also didn't last very long, and just 2 years later, Abdul Muttalib passed away. Muhammad is sometimes referred to as the triple orphan, and this is why. His father died before he could even see him, his mother died when he was 6, and in quick succession, his grandfather, who had basically been the father figure in his life, filling in for Abdullah, died when he was just 8. Muhammad was then transferred into the custody of Abu Talib, who was one of his senior uncles, and actually happened to be his full uncle. Abdul Muttalib, throughout his life, had side children with multiple wives. So Muhammad actually had quite a few uncles, but most of them were half uncles. Abu Talib and Abdullah were full brothers. They had the same mother. And so Abu Talib was the one that was entasked with taking care of Muhammad because of their closer link. As an orphan, Muhammad now had no father figure in his life, no one that would give him the special attention that a young boy deserved and that a young boy craved. He didn't have a father figure that would guide him the same way a father would. Under the tribal system that existed in the Bedouin culture prevailing in Mecca, the head of a clan had a certain responsibility to provide for and help the weaker or poorer members of his clan. It was like an unwritten law that existed because there was no upheld requirement that was enforced or set in stone, but if the head of a clan did not help out weaker or poorer members of his clan, for example, if a member of his clan was, for one reason or another, unable to get a hold of enough food for themselves to survive, they would simply starve and waste away if they weren't aided by an external factor, a third party. And so allowing a member of your clan to starve to death would become ammunition for other, maybe rival clans to mock and ridicule you with, which was, as we have discussed extensively, a big no-no for the proud Arabian psyche. For those reasons, Muhammad's guardians made sure that he did not starve to death, but that was the limit to the support that he may have received from them. Also, in this particular situation, it was quite difficult for his clan to do anything more than that for their orphan kinsmen, as the fortunes of the clan of Hashim, the Beni Hashim, had stooped down, and they seemed to be declining at this point in time. As Muhammad began to grow up, opportunities were very limited for him, and so he found himself working the most menial basic job available in Mecca, a herder. The people in Mecca would hire people to take their herds out to the surrounding land in order to find pastures that could sustain their herds. This is what Muhammad's early adult life and what we would now consider adolescence and late childhood even would have entailed. Camping out outside of Mecca, leading herds of animals around the desert, seeking water holes and suitable grazing grounds, and then returning to Mecca periodically so that the owner of the herd could pay him and so that the owner of the herd could benefit from his herds. Compared to the amount of information that we have on Muhammad's later life, for example in Medina, we don't know that much of his life in Mecca, especially during his youth and early manhood. However, there are two events from this period that Muhammad is involved in to some extent. And these events are quite notable in their own right, but they also serve as particularly useful checkpoints for our podcast, as these events manage to shed a light on the situation in Mecca and its developments as a rising power in Western Arabia. The first of the two events is Harb al-Fijar, the Fijar War, which translates to the Wicked War or the Sacrilegious War, which I think is a better and more appropriate translation. And it was named this because the participants in the war didn't uphold the sacred laws and they simply ignored them. They spilled blood within the holy sanctuaries and they spilled blood during the holy months. This war began originally as a quarrel between two nomadic chiefs. One was leading a caravan from Iraq to a very popular grand 20-day fair at a place called Uqaz in Central Arabia, not far from Mecca. The other guy basically ambushed the caravan, and we're not even totally sure why he did this, but it's suspected that it was because the caravan had passed through his territory without paying him what he saw as appropriate respect or asking for permission. Regardless of the reason, the man, along with the people accompanying his caravan, had been treacherously murdered, and avenging them was an absolute necessity. The Quraysh through their extensive alliance system, ended up getting involved. Actually, on the side of the aggressor. The sequence of events, as you can imagine by now, had followed the usual Bedouin desert pattern. Honor demanded revenge, and so the tribe of the murdered man attacked Kinana. And Kinana was the tribe of the murderer, and so Quraysh were dragged in as allies of the Kinana tribe. The Meccans were particularly motivated to get involved as this conflict pitted them against their rivals from the city of Ta'if, and also because due to their commercial interests, they were looking to extend their influence and to gain a controlling hand over the Fair of Uqaz. After a few early defeats, Quraysh were ultimately victorious, and their victory meant a rise in prestige, especially after their defeat of their neighbouring rivals from Ta'if. More importantly, in the grand scheme of things, Quraysh had managed to garner for themselves an extension of their influence and an extension of their commercial network at the expense of the rival powers around them. They also managed to get what they wanted, which was a measure of control over the Fair of Uqaz. Muhammad was around the age of 15 when this war occurred, and although during one of the battles where Quraysh and their allies had the worst of the day and ended up being somewhat overcome, Muhammad, while on the losing side, was able to show his skill as a bowman during the thick of the battle, and he was praised for his courage and his valour in light of the situation. His role normally had been much more limited. He was one of the boys that would gather arrows for the fighters, and he would also stand by the archers and hand them an arrow every time they were about to shoot, so that they didn't have to waste precious time scrambling about reaching for an arrow to fire. In effect, this allowed the archers to have a higher rate of fire for a more effective ranged attack. In the shadow of this war occurs a second event. A merchant from Yemen had come to Mecca and sold some valuable goods to one of the chiefs of Quraysh. This chief then refused to pay the promised price, and he refused to pay the merchant what he owed him for the goods. The wrong merchant was a stranger in Mecca. He knew it, and the chief knew it. He was actually in a very precarious situation because he had no kinsmen or confederates in Mecca. He didn't even have a patron or someone from Mecca as a sponsor who would usually be tasked with helping him out in a situation like this. So the merchant, due to his current helpless and somewhat desperate situation, went to a public spot that was frequented by a lot of people and called out loud, appealing to the people of Mecca as a whole. He implored them to see that justice was done. Luckily, the merchant received a response, and there was a vigorous reaction from a large number of clans of Quraysh who came together and initiated what became known as Hilf al-Fudul, the League of the Virtuous. The League aimed to uphold justice and commercial integrity, and so the members of the League went to the offending chief who had withheld promised payment, and they basically strong-armed him into paying his debts and giving the Yemeni merchant what he had promised to pay him. At first glance, this seems to be simply a question of principles and honor demanding that they uphold justice. However, when we look closer, we see two things. The first is that the tribes or the clans that entered this alliance were mostly the same clans from the earlier split in Mecca after the death of Qusay. If you remember, it was the split between the sons of Abd Manaf, Bani Abd Manaf, and the sons of Abd al-Dar over the responsibilities. In fact, amongst the clans that had sided with Bani Abd Manaf in that conflict, only three of those clans were absent as members of the League of the Virtuous. So we have remnants of that earlier conflict and a maintenance of the same rivalries within Quraysh that had existed a few generations earlier, still existing and driving them to oppose and undermine one another. The other thing that we see is that the withholding of payment by this Qurayshi chief was probably part of a wider scheme that deliberately attempted to stop Yemeni merchants from coming to Mecca and sharing in the lucrative trade and profits that were available at the Meccan end. They aimed to restrict the Yemeni merchants to trade in their own territory in Yemen, while the organization of the caravans was to be ideally entirely in the hands of the Meccans. Now, this seems like a sound policy to pursue by the Meccans, so then why were there people in Mecca who worked against it by creating the League of the Virtuous? Well, again, when we look at the clans that formed it, we notice that actually the majority of them were either incapable of sending caravans south to the Yemen, or they were, for example, like the clan of Beni Hashim, which was the clan that Muhammad belonged to, was specialized in the trade up north in the Levant in Syria with the Byzantines. So it would not be in the interest of these clans for Yemeni traders to be restricted in their trade with Mecca, because then the only way that they would be able to get a hold of goods from down south would be through the Meccans that were able to send caravans constantly and consistently to Yemen, which would give them an upper hand, because it would basically be somewhat of a monopoly on Yemeni goods. The clan of Beni Hashim played a leading role in the League of the Virtuous, and so Muhammad, as a member of the clan of Hashim, of the Beni Hashim, was directly involved as a sworn member within the League. Unfortunately, that is all for today's episode. Join me next week, where we will continue on our journey through Muhammad's life, and where we will arrive at the beginning of Revelation and the beginning of prophethood. I also want to inform you that beginning from next week, I'm going to aim to answer at least one question from the listeners in the footnotes section. So if you have a question or some kind of query that you want answered, then head over to the blog, historyofislampodcast.blogspot.com, and go over onto the contact page where you can send me a message and your question might feature in the footnotes. This episode will contain some footnotes, so if you want to carry on listening after the end of the theme music, feel free to do so. Goodbye. Now listening to the footnote segment. First of all, I just want to thank all of you for the support. You know who you are. Today we only have a very short footnote segment. I just want to rectify two mistakes from the previous episode. They are slips of the tongue, really. The first is that I ended the Abdul Muttalib sacrifice saga by saying that he sacrificed 10 camels. This was a slip of the tongue. What I meant to say was that he had the expensive task of sacrificing 100 camels. The second is that I said that Umayyah ibn Abd al-Shams, the cousin of Abdul Muttalib, was the son of Qusay, or a son of Qusay. This was a mistake. What I meant was that he was a descendant of Qusay, so not a direct son of Qusay, which would have been obvious in the context, but I managed to somehow brain fart and say that. Qusay is actually his great-grandfather. It's Umayyah ibn Abd al-Shams ibn Abd al-Manaf ibn Qusay. Again, if you don't remember, ibn means son of. So Umayyah was the son of a man called Abd al-Shams, who was the twin of Hashim. Hashim was Abdul Muttalib's father, so Abdul Muttalib and Umayyah were cousins. Umayyah's grandfather was Abdul Manaf. Abdul Manaf was a son of Qusay, and he was the man that was snubbed for the responsibilities. So again, if you're interested in all these intricacies in the genealogies and the family trees, and you want to know more about the rivalries that were present in Mecca, then head over to the episode guide or the gallery to see images of these family trees, or take part in the new scheme that I've initiated of answering one listener question, or at least one listener question every episode in a footnote segment, by going over to the podcast website and heading over to the contact page where you can send me a message. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.